This November, voters in Missouri approved the use of marijuana for medical purposes. As you may recall, there were three separate ballot measures relating to medical marijuana. The one that passed was known as Amendment 2. The Yes on 2 watch party election night started at 4:20. People ate ice cream sandwiches and listened to Bob Marley. The mood was celebratory. It was a big deal to see this thing pass. But what does it mean exactly? What's legal now, what's not, and how's it going to work? That reality is fairly nuanced and complicated. So today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to sort it out with our health reporter, who's been looking into the new law, and a lawyer who's invested in it, both personally and professionally. I'm Gina Kaufman here with KCUR's Alex Smith. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Gina.
As some listeners know, you are my husband, but we'll be keeping today's pot discussion super newsy and profesh. On that note, lay out the basics of what actually passed on the Missouri ballot last month.
Well, last month, Missouri voters passed Amendment 2, which does legalize medical marijuana in the state and creates a pretty big system for just, you know, how that's going to work, how people are going to get access to it, how the businesses are going to work. Basically, I mean, this is going to be a really big change in Missouri for healthcare, for business, in a lot of areas.
What do you think are some common misconceptions out there?
I think some people had this idea that if a ballot measure passed, they'd be able to wake up on November 7th, go to their doctor, and get marijuana, or at least that it would happen pretty quickly. In fact, you know, this is going to be a really big change for the state, and the amendment requires a lot of licensing, certification, inspections, and the creation, I mean, essentially of a pretty big division within the state health department before any of this is available to patients. And right now, the state is saying probably at the soonest the soonest this is going to be available to patients will be the start of 2020.
How will it work? How will patients whose doctors think they might benefit from marijuana go through the proper steps to get it?
Well, so even though Missouri passed this amendment, medical marijuana is still illegal under federal law. So doctors can't actually prescribe it or technically even advise patients on how to use it. All they can really do is give patients a recommendation that says they could benefit from medical marijuana. The patient will then, you know, once they get that recommendation, they then take it to the health department, the state health department.
But wait. Can we slow down?
Sure.
How does that differ from saying they can't recommend it, they can't advise, but they can write a note saying they might benefit?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a technicality, but basically, I mean, if you go to a doctor and they prescribe a medication, they can have pretty, you know, detailed instructions on, you know, this is how you use it. You know, this is the dosage that you take. This is kind of what the side effects could be. I mean, they can really break down in a lot of detail, you know, just what you should expect from this medication and what the outcomes will be. Right now, I mean, doctors just don't have that information. I mean, technically, medical marijuana is not legal under federal law. There's not like a lot of prescribing guidelines. It's basically, I mean, I think it creates sort of an awkward position for a lot of doctors because, you know, a lot of them do recognize that there could be some potential health benefits, but they don't really know. I mean, honestly, the most that a doctor can really do at this point is just say, well, you know, if you think this could help you, I can give you a recommendation and, you know, see if it works for you and come back and tell me what you think.
So it's like, if this is something that works, you might be someone it works for?
Right.
Okay, so we've gotten up to the recommendation. What then?
So then, yeah, once a patient gets a recommendation, then they go to the state. The state gives them an identification card. I mean, sometimes those are called green cards. And then the patient takes the green card to a dispensary where they can actually buy the medical marijuana.
It all sounds kind of like you're playing Monopoly or something, like you get your card, you pass go.
Right. There's a lot of stages to this. It's not just like the floodgates are open.
What is the feeling that you're getting about all of this from the medical community here in town, or I guess in the state?
Well, medical marijuana does have a lot of support from the general public. But again, I mean, doctors are pretty cautious about this. So there was a survey of the Medical Society in Kansas City earlier this year, and it found that most doctors wouldn't recommend medical marijuana even if they were legally able to. I mean, we could see maybe that will change now that it actually is legal. But again, their big concern is about just the lack of hard evidence and treatment guidelines. And so I think, you know, again, since doctors, all they can really do is write a recommendation and say good luck to you, that's a really uncomfortable position. That's not the way doctors generally like to operate. So I think a lot of doctors who I've spoken to, even if they are cautious about medical marijuana, they do want to see more research going into it. They do want to be able to at least tell their patients, you know, whether this is something that they could benefit from or whether this could be dangerous for them. So I think doctors right now are kind of in an awkward position of just sort of figuring out what their next steps are.
They would like more evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting because you hear these stories out of California that are like, you know, where it seems pretty, like, very casual. Is the medical community here just maybe different in spirit or...
Well, yeah, that's hard to say. I mean, as we have seen, like you can go to parts of California, Venice Beach, where you just walk into, you know, kind of a quote unquote doctor's office and you say, you know, I have, you know, stress or whatever, and you might be able to get a green card there, go right next door and go to a dispensary. So I think that there is... In Missouri, the law seems to be written to avoid that kind of situation. And a lot of doctors don't want to be in that kind of position where it's just sort of, you know, kind of a wink, wink, nod, nod thing on medical marijuana. And the law is written, you know, very, very carefully to make sure that it doesn't get diverted just for recreational purposes and the people who actually need it will get access to it.
What is there to know from a business standpoint? There must be tons of would-be entrepreneurs who are pretty eager to get in on the game. Like what lies ahead for them?
Well, yeah, that's another really interesting part of this. I have talked with a lot of advocates who, you know, just kind of casually mention, you know, I want to start a dispensary or, you know, some sort of little business, you know, involving this. And I think, you know, there may have been a time, you know, years ago or maybe even decades ago in California or wherever, where somebody could start a mom and pop business and do really well. But to be honest, I think that time is probably behind us. I mean, there are so many rules and regulations and requirements that someone has to follow. And on top of that, there already are a lot of really successful businesses and entrepreneurs in other states who are just, you know, ready to basically pounce in Missouri as soon as they get the chance to go into business here. So there will probably be a lot of demand and money to be made, but this is not easy money. I mean, unless somebody really understands the business and the legal requirements, the security and safety issues, they're going to have a hard time just doing this from scratch.
Well, let's turn to our next guest. She's a lawyer, and she did some consulting for New Approach Missouri on this ballot measure, Amendment 2, legalizing medical marijuana at the state level. An important detail, as we've heard. Aubrey Gann Redman, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So this detail about medical marijuana still being legal at the state level, but illegal at the federal level. Can you tease that out a little bit, how that plays out?
So basically, under federal law, you've got the Controlled Substances Act, which has marijuana or cannabis, as I like to refer to it, as a Schedule I controlled substance. So because of that, you're going to run into issues with banking. You're going to run into issues with gun rights and gun laws.
And wait, what? Why?
Well, because of background checks. So it might make it impossible for someone who has a medical card to pass a background check through the ATF in order to buy a weapon.
I see. Okay. And other things that'll come up likely as a result of this discrepancy between the state and federal approach to this issue?
Well, I think a lot of the issues here are that states, and it's becoming a 10th Amendment issue. So now we have over 32 states, I believe, in the country who have legalized marijuana, whether recreationally or medically. And so at that point, the federal government is going to have a ways to go to catch up. And one of the things that the federal government is doing is you'll see the Farm Bill is coming up for a vote here by the end of this month to legalize industrial hemp. So that is going to be I think, one of the first steps that this country takes to take industrial hemp off of Schedule 1. And actually, in the state of Missouri, we have taken industrial hemp off of the Controlled Substances Act as a Schedule 1 narcotic as well. It's the same plant, but hemp has less than 3% THC in it. And so I think what you're going to see is once it becomes legal federally, they may begin increasing the levels that are acceptable nationwide.
But it does seem like this whole thing is very tricky to navigate when the state law falls under federal law, but is also separate, and there's this tension.
Right. And so I think one of the practical problems that we're going to be facing in the state of Missouri is the application process is going to begin in June. So Department of Health and Human Services is going to make these applications available for patients, caregivers, home grow for patients and caregivers, and then also business owners. They will begin accepting these applications for patients, caregivers, and home grow in July, and they'll have a 30-day turnaround on those. On August 3rd, they will accept applications for the business owners. And what you're going to see is if some patient gets accepted for a medical card and home grow, they can start their crop at home, up to six plants, in August. They might have a plant ready to harvest in November. But these businesses that apply in August have a 150-day turnaround on their applications. The first dispensary may open in January 2020, but where's their inventory going to come from? So the issue is going to be they can't import it because of federal law, because of interstate commerce. And so are we going to go the way of Detroit and allow people to sell their excess from home grow, have the caregivers sell the excess from home grow to the dispensaries to get them by in the meantime? I've been told the answer to that question is no, but we're in the process of promulgating regulations and ordinances, and I think it remains to be seen.
What are some of the other big questions people are asking from a legal standpoint right now?
Well, the most popular topic that I've seen so far has to do with employers. So let's say you get a medical card. Are you going to be able to partake of your medical marijuana or your medical cannabis and then show up to work the next day? And if you get drug tested, are you going to be able to keep your job? Amendment 2 says that there is no protection for an employee from getting terminated or discriminated against if they show up to work under the influence, but marijuana stays in a system for 28 days minimum. So how are they going to determine whether or not you're under the influence at work or not? If, say, you've taken it the night before, you're not under the influence the next day, but it's still showing up in your system. And the trend on the East Coast and some of the cases I've been seeing out there is that, well, if the employer can't show that you're under the influence at the time that you are at work, then you should be protected because you have a medical right under state law to be using this substance.
Call 816-235-2888 with your questions about medical marijuana in Missouri. 816-235-2888. Aubrey, you know a lot about this.
Well, I come from a probate and trust litigation background. So for the last 10 years, I've been seeing clients who have serious debilitating injuries, terminal illnesses, and disabilities, who have had to go to other states to get relief and have tried medical cannabis, and it has given them a lot of relief. I've seen clients who have had children with really bad seizure disorders get relief from it, as much as going from 100 seizures a day down to 5 or less with the use of cannabis oil. I've seen people get relief from chronic pain. So I tend to believe that this works, and I'm very passionate about it, especially for cancer patients and people suffering from PTSD. And so I think it's an important move that Missouri has made, and I'm excited about it.
You've developed a form, and I'd like you to explain it. First of all, what it is for and why it exists.
Well, When a patient begins the dialogue with their doctor about whether or not to get certified, because it can't be a prescription because you're not getting it from a pharmacy. So it's a certification. I looked at Amendment 2. I looked at some forms from the other states that have been doing this a long time. And we took the language from Amendment 2 from the qualifying conditions, and they have a list of about 10, and put that language directly into a certification form that a patient can take to their doctor and begin that dialogue with their doctor. And if their doctor thinks it's going to be beneficial for them to try, the doctor can fill out the form, and then that form will be the basis for the patient's application for a medical card.
How do doctors typically respond to something like this coming from a lawyer? It's interesting to me because you think of formalities and prescription writing is coming from the medical community. And so this, although it does sound also from what Alex told us, like doctors don't know what to do with this.
Right. And so Amendment 2 allows doctors to do a handwritten note. They allow doctors to do a typewritten note, something submitted online. But the thing is how's a doctor going to know what to put into that note? And how are we going to know what's sufficient or not when the patients go to apply? Because we've never done it before here. So taking a form to a doctor might be one way to pique the doctor's interest and to help educate the doctor. You've already got the statutory language in the form. They just got to check some boxes and fill some things out. And it might make it easier and more approachable for a doctor to have a conversation with the patient.
Well, when we pick back up with this conversation, we'll hear the story behind Aubrey's passion for this issue and how it intersects with her own family's journey. We'll also take your questions about the law that made medical marijuana legal in Missouri, even though it's still illegal on the federal level. How will this work? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm here with KCUR's Alex Smith. He is our health reporter. Hi, Alex. I'm also joined by a local attorney, Aubrey Gann Redman. One of her specialties is medical cannabis law. She works with people who want to open dispensaries and people with medical conditions that have them seeking out medical marijuana for treatment. Hi again, Aubrey.
Hello.
Call 816-235-2888 with your questions, although we already have a lot of calls, so you may want to send those questions as a tweet. We are at KCURCST. Aubrey, you are really passionate about this, about medical cannabis law. And I understand that it is really personal for you on a family level.
It is. You know, I've had family members in the last year. One was my own mother who fought and lost a battle with cancer. And when it's one thing to work with clients over the last decade and watch their struggle and really empathize with them and see what they go through, it's another thing that brings it right to your doorstep when you're dealing with a very beloved family member who falls ill and you just watch the pain and the suffering. And there is no person on this planet who wouldn't do anything in their power to try to alleviate the suffering of someone that they love. And so having that option is really important.
And so we've talked about that you are a member of the New Approach Missouri group.
Correct.
And that when this amendment was really getting pushed through was exactly when you were in the depths of this with your mother.
That's correct. So at the outset, when this was happening, and I'd been working with some clients who had dispensaries and operations in other states. We knew it was going to come here. And then our family just went through a very difficult time. And I didn't get the opportunity to be as active in getting this on the ballot as I would have liked, but I worked with people who did, and just so proud of the efforts and so grateful for all the groundwork that everyone had put into this, not just for my family, but for all the other families out there that are going through something similar.
Alex, you know, when Aubrey tells the story of her family and of the clients that she's represented, how does that fit in with the stories you typically hear or read about in your reporting?
Yeah, there are absolutely some really cases where, you know, people are in, you know, really difficult situations. I mean, you know, suffering from epilepsy that doesn't really respond to medical treatment, or with Aubrey's mom, cases of terminal cancer where there's a lot of chronic pain. And, you know, while there is not a lot of, you know, FDA approved uses for cannabis, I mean, there is some pretty strong research that shows that medical marijuana can help in a lot of those situations. And I think for a lot of patients who are dealing with those issues, I mean, this is a pretty big, you know, victory and something that they are very hopeful about that can help them.
Let's talk to Heather calling us from St. Joseph, Missouri. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
What do you want to share or ask?
Yeah, my question is, now that Missouri has it legal on a medical level, can someone who was convicted of marijuana possession in the past obtain a medical card?
This seems like a question for Aubrey.
So what's very interesting is our legislative session coming up from January to May. I've been told there is a state representative who intends to propose a bill that if you have a marijuana conviction on your record and this bill passes, it will take those marijuana convictions off of everybody's records, which I think is huge. And if you are interested in something like that, please throw your support behind that bill by, you know, going down to Jeff City, calling people, letting them know how important that support is for you, because I think that once the regulations are passed, those issues will be addressed. But right now, until we get more firm regulations and ordinances in place, those kinds of questions are going to be kind of difficult to answer.
Let's talk with Julie in Leawood, or excuse me, with David in the West Plaza. Hi, David.
Hi.
What do you want to add?
Well, my question is that I have a brother-in-law who lives in Oregon, and he claims that Oregon has set up a system of testing, too, because I would really think it'd be good that the health department, well, when you buy something, what you're buying, when it says how many milligrams of CBD or THC is in it, it actually has that. And then at the post where they use, like, pesticides, you know, to grow it.
So you want, you know, to know whether you'll be able to know what exactly you're getting.
Well, are we going to do some testing? You know, like, when you buy alcohol, it has to have much percentage of alcohols in the bottle, you know. But it would be assuring that, you know, it's just, you know, that's tested. You know, we're ensuring the quality of the product.
Okay, let's find out what we know about that and perhaps what we don't know about that. Will there be some way for a patient who is not prescribed but recommended medical marijuana, will they be able to know details about the THC levels and other things?
Absolutely, because anybody who is in the dispensary business can tell you that they interface with the patients. And so these dispensary owners are going to be very savvy on their products, the packaging and the labeling. There are going to be stringent requirements on those. And so if anybody has any questions when they go to a dispensary, your best bet is to open up a dialogue with the folks that run the place and who are providing you that product, and to talk to them about what products are appropriate for your qualified condition.
Alex, anything to add on what you're hearing so far from our listeners and from our lawyers' answers?
Well, yeah, just that there will be, you know, testing for everything that's sold. I mean, there's a pretty, you know, very careful sort of tracking mechanism from the seed to the point of sale, and that includes testing, you know, and that testing has to be done by people who are not involved in the sale or the growing or anything like that. So, yeah, I think we should be able to see pretty clearly, you know, what the potency is, what the THC concentration is, and people will be able to make up their mind about, you know, exactly what they want to buy based on that.
Let's talk to Julie in Leawood. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I have a two-part question. One, so we all live close to a state line, obviously. How will this relay, since the law was passed in Missouri, if you're a resident in Kansas, can you get it? Or if you have it in your possession, but you have a card, but you're in Kansas, what are the legal ramifications for that? And then the second part of my question is, what laws are in place to protect, to monitor, protect, whatever, people driving under the influence of it, and the safety issues around that?
Okay. So two-parter. Let's start with that first part, the state line. How's the state line going to affect people on this?
So only Missouri residents are going to be able to apply for a medical card. And again, because it's illegal federally, you can't transport it across state lines. So that's number one. Number two is the DUI laws are definitely going to be enforced when it comes to driving under the influence of medical cannabis.
It's interesting. You know, there are a lot of medications that indicate you should not drive while you're taking them. Like, I mean, I think even maybe Benadryl.
Correct.
And so how it's an interesting thing to think about, because obviously it is a safety issue, but I've never been pulled over, you know, and had someone ask me if I've had Benadryl.
Well, I think, you know, and this is getting into a bit of criminal law, and I did do some criminal law earlier in my career. I can tell you that they have something. They do have special officers that give exams, special exams above and beyond what you would think of for alcohol, to determine whether or not a person has ingested something that would impair their ability to drive, whether it's, say, psychedelic mushrooms or opiates or whatever the case may be. So there's a whole special drug examination officer process that if they think that you're on something and it's not alcohol, they can bring in one of those specialized officers.
Let's talk to Nick. Nick is calling us from Cathedral City, California, which might seem odd, except that he is interested in opening a business here in Kansas City, and he discloses that he is a client of Aubrey's. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
What do you want to share?
Well, what I want to share is the medical card. In California, most people strayed away from the medical cards, but what I want to tell them is California's gone recreational. And when we went to recreational cannabis, we saw more patients than we ever saw who carried a medical recommendation.
So wait, can we back up a second? Oh, can you tell us a little sure. bit more about who you are and what you do, so that when you say we, we'll all be following you?
Well, I'm Nick Hughes from Cathedral City Care Collective in California. I've had two dispensaries. One was strictly medical, and the other one now is recreational and medical. We also have a consumption lounge. For the lady who called in about driving with it, it's don't drive and use any cannabis product, because it's not safe. It's not safe for you. It's not safe for the other drivers. But it's better than drinking alcohol and driving. Do not do that, especially.
But, okay. So back to what you were wanting to say about cards.
Oh, the cards. What I want to convey to the real patients out there, people with Crohn's disease, people with neuropathy, people who have bursitis or arthritis, there are great topicals that are available that are cannabis related. They carry CBDs. They also have THC. If you can't sleep, THC is a great sleep aid.
You are an enthusiast, Nick.
Oh, absolutely. But I want people to realize that the card, the medical card, should not be a wall that they stay away from it. Because
okay.
if you're having trouble with, like I said, neuropathy, I have neuropathy in one of my feet. And so I use a topical that I put on before I go to bed, and I have no pain. My mother has Crohn's disease. And with Crohn's disease, you get severe stomach cramps and you get a digestive inflammation. With a tincture or sublingual, you can get rid of those cramps. And especially at night, you take it at night. In the morning, you don't wake up with cramps that are very severe. I mean, they'll double you over for hours.
Okay, Nick, I'm gonna get our guests back in on this conversation, but thank you for sharing your experience. Alex, you know, when he talks about all of these different forms that medical cannabis can take, what insights do you have into, you know, what the medical community here is saying about that?
Well, again, I mean, there has not been a lot of, you know, big kind of high level testing done on this in the federal level. I mean, these things are not, for the most part, approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So, I mean, we do hear a lot of anecdotal things, you know, that give patients, you know, cause for hope. But, you know, again, we do want to be cautious here about, you know, just what exactly all of these different treatments do. I mean, how effective they are, how they compare with the treatments that are already there. So, it's just good to view all these things with a little bit of caution.
You know, we mentioned that last caller was your client, Aubrey. What interests me here is that you are this expert who represents clients in all these other states from a state where it just became legal, where we're just starting this process. And I'm guessing that most lawyers here are just starting their learning process. How did this come to be that you're like this specialist in this kind of law here?
Well, I would hesitate to call myself a specialist or an expert because I always feel like I don't ever know enough. And I'm constantly learning every single day. And my clients have taught me so much and they continue to teach me so much about how this process works. And every state is different. So we hear about their experiences. We see the forms that they've used. And how I came across a lot of these clients is maybe their family, for instance, Nick is from here originally. And so they have ties to this state. They've got family here. Maybe they have a loved one that's getting put under a guardianship or conservatorship. Maybe there's a trust with assets here. That's how I've been fortuitous enough to come into contact with these folks. And it has been a journey that just keeps on going. And so when they need a lawyer here and they know that I'm passionate about this topic as well, we help each other out. They educate me. I help to educate them. And we're in this together.
What questions do you still have, even now that this law has passed?
So, again, one of my big questions is, what are these dispensary owners going to do when we open up in January 2020? Where are they going to get their inventory from? Are they going to be sitting ducks for 3 or 4 months while they incur all these expenses? What cities are going to be amenable to this? We're still going around talking to anybody who will meet with us saying, what kind of ordinances are you going to put in place and how can we help?
Alex, any questions you still have that are on your mind?
Well, I think it'll just be really interesting to see how, you know, the government is able to really follow all of the deadlines that are laid out for us and, you know, just when this is actually going to be up and running.
Alex Smith, thank you. I'll see you later.
Thank you, Gina.
Aubrey Gann Redmond, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back, this time with Mariachi. That's next. Stay tuned. Our next guest on KCUR's Central Standard is a musician. She's a big deal. She won a Latin Grammy, and she's in an all-women's mariachi band in Brooklyn. Before we get to what she's doing in Kansas City, let's just give her music a little listen. This is a song by Mariachi Flor de Toloache featuring Mireya Ramos on the fiddle. Okay, I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm here with Mireya Ramos. And Mireya, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me about your band, first of all, your all-women's mariachi band, which we are listening to right now.
Yes, we're New York City's first all-female mariachi. We're a multicultural band. We started in 2008. It's been an exciting adventure. It's taken a lot longer, I'd like to say, but it's been beautiful, and now we get to travel and share our music all over the world.
Why is it important to you that this band be a group of women performing this music?
Well, it's a male male-dominated genre, and it's very traditional. And the fact that we are all women is a big statement, but also what the way that we're doing the music, you know, we have taken this tradition and make it our kind of our own and give it our own touch and our New York, our New York touch to it. So we wear pants, which is not traditional in the mariachi tradition, and we do a lot of fusion, which is also sometimes seen a little people criticize us for the pants and for the fusion that we do. So
take me back to the decision that you would, because it sounds like this is like we always wear pants.
Yes, absolutely.
Take me back to that decision.
Well, we started wearing skirts, but of course we've always been a very creative with everything, with the music and how we look and our appearance. So we wore our skirts that we made ourselves, and they were up to the knee, which is also not traditional. But if you're in New York City and if you're taking the subway and you're running around gig to gig, it's not very practical to wear a skirt. So we decided to wear pants, and it's become a statement for our band and also a conversation.
You know, I understand that the song we just heard means a lot to you.
Absolutely. It's called Ruiseñor, which means nightingale. And it means a lot to us because it's in traditional form of son, which is a very traditional rhythm for mariachi. And in the context of that, it's a women's perspective song. So it's a beautiful thing that we can write our own songs and put our perspective on it, but it's also encouragement for women to speak their mind and their thoughts and never let their voice be silenced. So that's what the song is about.
You won a Latin Grammy.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
It was really exciting. It was a true dream come true. We had been working really hard to get to that point, and it was our second album. So we didn't know, obviously, had no idea we were going to win. But we also got to perform at the Latin Grammys, which was all made it even more exciting. And it's the first time that an all-female group wins in this category, Best Ranchero Album. And it's also the first time that it's been telecasted. So it was a huge deal, not just for us, but for all women in the industry.
What's your personal history, like your childhood, your family?
Well, my dad is from Michoacán, Mexico, and my mother's from Dominican Republic. I was raised in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and I've been in New York for about 18 years, and I've been doing music since I've been there, mariachi, hip-hop, classical music, and classically trained. I've done salsa, I've done all kinds of music, so New York, it's been amazing to me in that way.
How did you come to be connected to Kansas City?
Through Bo Blatto, I am very grateful. He had invited me a couple years ago to come and do his series with Ensemble Iberica. They do a beautiful series throughout the whole year. And I've been able to come here a couple of times, and then he connected me with Making Movies, which is doing amazing work here in Kansas City, and they've become also our musical family. So it's been amazing. I love Casey.
So you have, as you've mentioned, two big collaborations here in town. One is with Bo Bledsoe, and you've mentioned one of his projects. He's just sort of broadly like a global classical guitarist is the best way I can put that. But I'm going to play a little taste of the music that you have made with him. I'm wondering if you can tell us what we're hearing right now.
Yes, this is this is a ranchera, which is a type of song that I love to sing. It's like a hard felt song. I like to compare it to country music, but it's called Hay Unos Ojos.
What is this song about?
It's describing these beautiful eyes that you just, when you look at them, your whole body shakes and it makes you feel these beautiful things. So it's just a love song.
When you collaborate with Bo Bledsoe, what do you find in him as a collaborator that's, you know, brings you across many states?
Well, performing with him is just, he's so good at just knowing what you're going to sing and just feeling what you're singing. And so it's a great match. You know, he's so, like you said, he's a global guitar player, and all his influences come, you know, he expresses them when he's performing with you. So it's amazing to perform with him. I trust him. I close my eyes and it just magic happens. So I'm very excited.
You mentioned earlier that of the things that people sort of like react to either favorably or sometimes unfavorably with your somewhat traditional but somewhat unconventional at the same time mariachi band is the fusion piece of it. Can you talk to me more about that?
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned before, mariachi is a very male-dominated still genre. And the fact that we wear pants, people have felt that is sometimes an insult to the uniform because they take a lot of pride on what the tradition is and what they wear and how you should wear it and how we represent it. But what we do it with love. I come from a mariachi tradition, so I've done my homework, and I have shared that with the rest of the band. And we started as any other mariachi. We played all traditional repertoire, and we also did our homework as a band. So we just put a lot of love into it, and I think it's a way of an evolution of mariachi, and it was going to come someday if it was not us, another band. So, but yeah, we get highly criticized on social media and sometimes in person.
Speaking of fusion, I mean, what are some of the other strands or musical traditions that people might hear in your music?
You can hear a little bit of jazz, soul, R&B, sometimes even other Latin American rhythms like Brazilian music, salsa, son cubano. So all those things you can hear it, and even rock too.
So you have a collaboration with Enrique Chi and making movies. We've talked to Enrique Chi a lot on this show. That's also a band making movies that is hard to pinpoint sort of genre wise. And, you know, Latin rock is, I guess, as close as people come, or rock en español. But at the same time, they are just their own sound.
Yeah, I mean, what I love about them is that you can hear all those influences. Like, they're based in KC, so you can hear the influences from here, but they're essentially a Latin band, Latin rock en español, and you can hear also the rock in it and then all these Latin rhythms in it. So it's a really eclectic sound and refreshing to hear that. I haven't heard another band like that in a long time, so it's pretty cool that we're collaborating with them.
Yeah, tell me more about that collaboration.
We have a song that came out not too long ago called Amor de Mis Amores. It's our first collaboration, and hopefully many more to come. We have a show coming up that we're doing in New York for APAP January 5th in the new year.
What is APAP?
APAP is a music conference that happens every year in New York City. It's one of the biggest ones in the nation. So very excited to be a part of it and to be performing together on stage.
You know, I asked you the question about Bo Bledsoe. What is it about that collaboration with him as a musician that brings you across all these states? Because New York has no shortage of musicians where you live. What is it about Enrique Chi and making movies that does that for you as well?
I think they think very similar, like us, in the way that they express all their influences through the music. And we just clicked instantly. And the fact that the work that he's doing here socially with the kids and his nonprofit organization and his global vision it goes in line with what we do as well. So I think it was just an instant click, and I think that we could do a lot more music together, hopefully in the new year.
Tell me more about your global vision.
It's definitely expressed in my band in Flor de Toloache. We're, like I said, multicultural band, but we're just so open to all kinds of music. And we love the fact that people can connect to us, even though sometimes they don't speak Spanish. Some of our songs are bilingual or just in English. And it just has this familiar sound, so people will instantly connect to our music, and that's part of the mission, you know, and the fact that we can connect with people like that through music is priceless. So we're very, very happy.
Tell me more about your relationship with your fans, because I'm going to embarrass her, but one of my colleagues who recommended that we do a show with you is so passionate about your music that as she composed a note to me about you, she also typed that it was bringing her to tears just thinking about it.
Oh.
And I'm sure that when someone feels that, they're usually not alone.
Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing to see when people share their stories with us. Like, for example, we had a show in SF Jazz about a year ago, and this family flew across country to come and see our show, and that unfortunately had just lost a kid, and they decided to, you know, just to be there and let our music heal them, and just them being there and sharing the story with us. And there's tons of other stories like that, and the fact that we can either heal or make people cry or bring joy to them is amazing. That's an artist's dream, you know.
How do you deal with the haters?
We just tune them out.
Easier said than done, though.
Yeah, absolutely. But we have so many people, great feedback. And this, like I said, the stories that people share with us are so amazing as well. So it balances out.
Is there a mariachi song that is like just part of the canon that's really inspiring to you that you go back to again and again?
Ooh, there's so many. There's one in our first album that I got to record was Cucuru Cucu Paloma. And I think almost every time I sing that and I close my eyes and when I open them, there's at least one person crying. It's the power of that song. So I love how that song makes people, you know, move.
What will people experience if they come to your show tonight at the Ship?
Well, tonight is, well, I love the Ship, first of all. The vibe there is, it's so cool. And the fact that I get to sing with Bo again and in another form in a country band, which is something that I've never done before other than with him. So it's going to be really exciting. We're going to be fusing ranchera with country music and some other stuff. So,
are you a listener of country music?
I didn't grow up listening to it, but I enjoy it, and definitely I love all kinds of music. So,
you love the Ship, which is part of that. You're like a Kansas City insider at this point, and yeah. I'm curious about that. You've talked about Kansas City as your musical family. Tell me more about what Kansas City means to you.
Well, a lot of people are like, that's so random, right? That you're in Kansas City. There's a girl coming from San Juan, Puerto Rico via New York. But it's about the music, and the music connects you to all kinds of people and that are in the same frequency as you, and the fact that you can collaborate and just make magic happen. You know, every time I come to KC, there's so much love, and it's beautiful, and I love KC.
Have you been working on recording an album here? Have I heard that right? Or no?
I was starting to do my arrangements for my solo album, and Bo and some of the musicians from Ensemble Iberica, Michael McClintock, and other ones that were able to be with me and just kind of spend a lot of time and doing all these arrangements. So we started doing that here, but I am recording it like in California, New York, wherever I can, you know.
But people will hear a Kansas City influence on that album?
Yeah, absolutely.
When is it out?
Not sure, but next year for sure.
Very cool. And so tonight at the Ship, you will be doing a country music fusion type thing, but we are listening right now as we go out to a song that you mentioned, a song you did with, that your mariachi band did with Making Movies here in Kansas City.
Yes.
Tell me more about this song.
Amor de mis amores is a like a conversation between this woman and this guy, and you know, they're parting ways, but she's like telling him like, hey, you know, I don't need you anymore. So it was really cool to do this with Enrique. It was like I would like to call it like Buena Vista Social Club meets rock and some other influences. It was pretty cool how it came out.
Mireya Ramos, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Mireya will be performing tonight at 8 at The Ship with some country music collaborators. And that is a wrap for today's Central Standard. Grab anything you might have missed later today at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where we archive all our conversations. And you can subscribe to have them sent to you like a podcast. Do that while you're there, kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, how about those Chiefs? Is this a bad time to talk about their name? We're going to do it. Tune in tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Sufriendo después del horror de verte con otro que...